Okay, so you probably had this discussion with your parents. Many people have said the only things you can count on are death and taxes. And that actually isn't, if you think about this, if you think about evolutionary time, that's not a very accurate statement. I mean, okay, yeah, death has been around a while. It's been around pretty much as long as life, but taxes are a fairly recent innovation. And so if you think about evolving in the world, you know, what can you really count on? Well, Ernest Hemingway said it best, the sun also rises. Of course, the only things you can really count on other than death are sunrise and sunset. And so the premise of the field of circadian rhythms is that the ability to endogenously measure time and use that time to anticipate these huge transitions, because everything changes when the sun comes up, everything changes when the sun goes down. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you get eaten. The early bird gets the worm, etc. And so the premise of the field for many years always has been that if you can measure time and use this innate time ability to anticipate these changes and adjust your biology to be appropriate, you'll accrue some sort of evolutionary advantage and proliferate. And it was purely a premise for many years, but I'll show you probably the most compelling data, although Mary might argue with me because I'm going to show you plant data and she would argue that it's chipmunks. But we can debate that later. So anyway, yeah, the rotation of the Earth on its axis means that evolution has occurred in an environment that changes drastically but predictably every day. And so if you have a clock that matches the environmental oscillation, that'll enhance fitness, the ability to survive and produce offspring. So we'll talk about that more in a bit. I want to define some terms for circadian rhythms. First, circadian is from the Latin circa, approximately dies day. So these are rhythms that have a period length of approximately, but not necessarily exactly, 24 hours. And they're endogenous, that is, they're internal, they're generated internally. They persist in the absence of environmental time cues. But as I just said, of course, we live in the real world, and there are strong time cues out there, like dawn and dusk, lighter temperature cycles. And these can be untrainable. These and other temperature cues will shift the clock to synchronize it with the local temporal environment. And we all know this, we've all been jet lagged, but we got better. And that's your clock in training to local time. To define a couple more terms, you can define some terms. You can model any sort of rhythmic behavior as a simple sine wave. And if you go from any consistent place on this curve, say peak to peak, that's defined as the period. You remember this from physics, of course. Phase is the time of any particular marker. It could be the peak, it could be the trough, but the time in the cycle at which that occurs. And of course, amplitude is a half the peak to trough distance. And I'll mention all of these over and over again. So what do we want to do today? I want to talk about some key concepts in circadian rhythms. I want to give a historical overview. And I want to really emphasize circadian rhythms in plants. And I want to try and sing the praises of model systems, the importance of model systems in studying biology. And my personal favorite model, Arabidopsis thaliana, an otherwise insignificant little weed. Then I want to talk about regulation of gene expression, because we're going to talk a lot about how the clock regulates gene expression. But don't you worry, it's going to be gentle. And I'm going to emphasize the theme of modularity. And then I'm going to get a little less gentle and talk about natural variation and quantitative trait loci, but I'll try and explain those. And then because it's the 200th anniversary of his birth, and because I'm a geneticist, I'm going to talk about Gregor Mendel with some probability and inheritance. So some of you may be a little surprised to realize you're about to embark on a genetics class. And then I want to try and get back to the real world and talk about the application of circadian rhythms biology to agriculture. So that's where we're going. But first, you all know about clocks because you've all read Shakespeare and you've all read Hamlet. And in Act 1, Scene 5, it's the battlement scene where Hamlet's talking to his father's ghost. The ghost says to him, "Fare thee well at once, the glowworm shows the matin to veneer, and gins to pale his ineffectual fire, adieu, 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 remember me," and then he exits. Well, what's going on there? The glowworm is a bioluminescent bug that's flying around, and in anticipation, the sun has not cracked the horizon, but in anticipation of that event happening, the glowworm gins to pale his ineffectual fire in order to avoid being eaten by the early bird. And so here's a classic example of a circadian rhythm in an organism and the fitness advantage that accrues from having this clock. You didn't know that Shakespeare was a naturalist. Do humans have biological clocks? Well, yes, they do. By the way, these are plaster of Paris casts, and timing is everything. I was coming back from China, and my wife was leaving me to go down to a meeting in Spain, so we had 50 hours in Paris. So, of course, we went to the Louvre, and it's full of, you know, old things and, you know, people with broken noses and stuff. But they had this modern art display in there, and we were walking out, and I looked, and I said, oh, my God, we had to go back in and take a bunch of pictures. So, but yeah, humans are highly rhythmic, and you all know this, right? But let's talk about some of the classic rhythms. So hormone levels, for example, plasma cortisol peaks at about dawn. Growth hormone, had I ever had any, would have peaked in the middle of the night. Potassium excretion, maximum in the daytime. Deep core body temperature hits a minimum. The darkest hour is just before the dawn. That's when your deep core body temperature is at the lowest. That's also when you're your stupidest, so watch out pulling those all-nighters. And I want to really emphasize this with rather a pompous title. This is a series of slides that I got from my friend Bill Schwartz, who, believe it or not, got a Nature paper out of this. So pay attention, students. Circadian dysrhythmia due to rapid transmeridional flight. That means jet lag. So that's an airplane. And basically, when you fly a long way, you shift a lot. So if you go to the West Coast, you shift 3 hours. If you go to Australia, you're shifting, you know, 12 or 13 hours. But you get better. But how quickly can you get better? So this plot actually looks at the number of hours you get better with successive days. And so if you fly east, you can shift about 2 hours in the first day. The dogma is you can sort of shift an hour a day, but this argues actually you're a little better. You can shift about 2 hours the first day, another hour, and then sequentially. And of course, it's important. You shift better if you're outdoor. Bright light really helps. If you fly west, and this is going to be, you can shift more rapidly. You can shift like 4 hours that first day. Now, this is important. Why is this important? Well, now, I'm Canadian. I could personally care less about baseball. So if you're crying about the Red Sox, you have my sympathy. But actually, it's easier to be a Red Sox than it is to be on the West Coast. So here's some baseball cities on the East Coast. Here's some on the West Coast. And of course, these guys, to play one of these guys, have to fly there, or these guys have to fly there, and they're three time zones. So is there any consequence of this jet lag stuff? And so if you're going westbound, of course, the Westerners are returning home, the Easterners are traveling, and eastbound vice versa. And so what Bill did was he went through a couple of, I think, one season of baseball, and he published this, as I say, in Nature. So if there's no travel, basically there's a slight home team advantage. The home team wins about 54% of the time. If you fly, if the team, the visiting team, just flew from the East Coast to the West Coast, and so they're off by 3 hours, it turns out the home team wins a little more, the Westerners win a little more, but not much more, about 56%, and that's not really different. But if the West Coast team flies to the East and then plays, look at that, there's a big jump to about 63%. And Bill points out that the year he did this study, the pennant race in one of the leagues was decided by one game, and that one game gave the advantage to the East Coast team over the West Coast team. So it really matters, and he came up with some, basically you're getting about a 10% performance decrement due to jet lag in these situations. That's equivalent to a sleep deprivation to 3 hours, or a 0.09% blood alcohol level. For those students here, I know you've never tried this, but that exceeds the threshold for impaired driving in most states. Or the ingestion of, I hope you haven't tried this either, 500 mg of hexobarbital. So it turns out, and you know, okay, that matters for baseball players. It matters for everybody in terms of their performance. So this is important. Now, historically, I'm going to do this because the advantage goes to plants. The first writings about circadian rhythms were in the 4th century BC with Androsthenes. who went off with Alexander the Great to define and conquer the known world. And he observed leaf movements of a tree, probably a tamarind, on an island it's probably Bahrain. And so it's leaf movements, and I'll show you tons of these in a minute. There was no indication that anyone suspected the endogenous self-sustaining nature of this rhythm. But here was an astute observer of the natural world, and he wrote it down. Not much happened for about 2,100 years. Then finally a French astronomer, that's for you, named de Marin, he tried to measure leaf movements of a sensitive heliotrope, probably a mimosa, in continuous light. He took advantage of what they have a lot of in France, which is wine cellars. And he took a sensitive plant down into a wine cellar, and he saw that the movement of the leaves persisted under the constant conditions of the wine cellar, where the temperature, as we know, it's important for your Bordeaux, is constant, and you don't have the light-dark cycles. In addition, actually, he was quite prescient because he suggested there might be a relation to the sleep rhythms that had been observed in bedridden patients. And of course there is. It's an underlying circadian rhythm in both plants and in people. About 30 years passed, and then a couple of books came out that basically managed to repeat that. I guess science proceeded a little more slowly in those days. But these guys also added on that there was they excluded temperature as an unseen Zeitgeber or time giver, a cue to reset the clock. And so the sorts of sleep movements that we're observing, people had to be really quite clever to measure these things. But here's an example of the night and day position for a bean plant, Phaseolus. And these are the sorts of examples of leaf movements you'd see. And if you're really clever, you can sort of tape a little thing to that, and you can, as the leaf goes up and down, the pin will scratch in candle black on the outside of these circular things. We have other ways to measure it now, but here's an example of one of these rhythms where the slash is every day. And you can see a nice, beautiful, robust position of the leaf up and down. One of the things, that the period's about 27 hours here, that was discovered actually in 1832. De Candolle actually, for the first time, thought to quantify, measure the period length. And he realized in Mimosa it was not 24 hours, about 22 to 23 hours. That actually, although they didn't appreciate it at the time, was really, really a crucial, crucial point, because in the 50s and 60s, there was this huge debate about whether or not these rhythms were endogenous or whether the organisms were somehow tracking some subtle geophysical cue that we couldn't measure because we didn't know what it was. And actually, the refutation of that assertion was the fact that the period was not 24 hours, because you'd figure some sort of basic geophysical cue based on the rotation of the Earth on its axis would have that periodicity, and they don't. So we're not tracking that. And it turns out it's endogenous. By the way, the finally, even though this I thought was a pretty compelling argument, when they finally put Neuraspora crassa up in, I think it was Skylab, and showed that the rhythms persisted in space, that really settled the question that it was not something associated with the Earth rotating on its axis. And so Charles Darwin, of course this is the year of Darwin, wrote a book in 1880 on the power of movements in plants, illustrated, I believe, by his son Francis. And people went around and measured leaf movements in tons of plants, and there's some beautiful drawings in that book. For those of you who work on animals, for almost 200 years, all rhythms research was on plants. There are those of us who would argue still the best remains in plants. The only known rhythm was in leaf movement. We didn't have a lot of variety. Finally, in 1894, somebody measured a rhythm in pigments in arthropods, I believe it was crabs. And it wasn't until 1922 that somebody showed there was an activity rhythm in a mammal, in this case, rats. Although there are those, like Mary, who would argue that maybe the animal kingdom is caught up. Many plant processes are rhythmic. Tons of things. I'm going to focus on gene expression and leaf movement, but all kinds of growth and development things. Petal opening, fragrance production, for those of you having a hard time with your hand cream, a lot of plants will produce those fragrances at specific times of day, appropriate to attract their pollinator, and so there's a lot of coevolution, actually, of plants and pollinators that way. So tons of rhythms, and actually it's getting kind of exciting because it's turning out that the ability to respond to the abiotic environment is actually regulated by the clock. Cold, for example, the ability to acclimate to cold is gated by the clock. Similarly, data are starting to accumulate that the response to the biotic environment is influenced by the circadian clock. I mean, the believers have always felt that was going to be true, but data are starting to accumulate to support that. And so this is going to be continue to be big for quite a while. And now I want to show you one of these, a movie of a plant that illustrates a lot of these points. It's done by my friend Roger Hangarter. And if you just Google Roger, you can get to the site Plants in Motion. And then you have to click the ticket to enter the Plants in Motion Theater. And so this is a movie. The star of this movie is a sunflower. Let's see if it goes. Okay, so the sunflower, we all know sunflower attracts the sun. So it's going to be moving, and here it is. He just filmed it in his backyard. And eventually it's going to move around, and you can see the light flex and so on and so forth. The sun's going to go down. It's going to get dark pretty soon. Oh, it's getting dark. It's going to remain lit by a single bulb over his back porch. The sun's going to come up over here in a minute. Oh, look what's happening. The sunflower is getting... So there you go, an endogenous rhythm in the day of the life of a sunflower plant. That's a classic example of what we're talking about. Now, sunflowers aren't my model system. I'm going to work in Arabidopsis thaliana. It is the, I should have put that in caps for the corn people, the model plant. It's a diploid. It's got good genetics. It's small and easy to grow, short generation times, small genomes, completely sequenced. But the real argument to work on it is there's a large community, so there's much less need to reinvent the wheel. Almost anything you want to do, somebody smarter and more ambitious than you has figured out how to do it, and you just have to plug and play. And this is, you're building, you're standing on the shoulders of giants, and it really has helped make a lot more progress than we would have achieved if we were all working on our own favorite plant. So I'm a big believer in models. And I want to show you the life cycle of Arabidopsis. As I said, I'm a Canadian. That's Regina Elizabeth, and that's an Arabidopsis seed. And you can germinate them, and here they are. There's a nickel. This is what we call a confluent monolayer. There it is, just sending up a flowering stalk. It grows as a basal rosette of leaves and sends up a stalk with little white flowers on the top. And there it is in its full majesty and glory. That is definitely bigger than life size. It stands maybe 20 centimeters in height. There's a lot of variation in that. And these are the other stars of the show, the people who did the work. These are people in my lab. And I'll show you work from Ping Lu. I'm not going to show you any work from Sung Hyun. Chigwang Shia and Xiaodong Xu, most of the work came from them, helped by Rachel McConnell, an undergraduate, and Allison Citro, another undergraduate. So those are the guys who did almost all the work that I'm going to show you today. So I mentioned this earlier. I showed you this slide, and I said I'm going to talk about leaf movement, and I'm going to talk about gene expression. And so gene expression, I'm going to talk about that first. So we're used to this idea, information gets stored, then you have to retrieve information, and then you put it into action. Biologically, how does that work? Well, typically, most organisms store their information as DNA. They convert it, they retrieve it through an informational intermediate called RNA, and then it gets converted into a protein that does stuff, is an enzyme or whatever. That's an oversimplification. There are tons of exceptions to that, but basically, this'll do. And so the DNA is organized into genes, and those are the elements that I'm going to talk about, gene expression. So a gene. And a gene gets transcribed into a messenger RNA, and that messenger RNA gets translated into another language, a protein, a sequence of amino acids, that I'm going to call a gene product. So that's really almost all you need to know about gene expression. But a couple more subtleties. Okay, your DNA and a plant's DNA is organized into a series of linear pieces called chromosomes. And chromosomes basically, this is again an oversimplification, but it's good enough, are a linear series of genes. And we're going to focus on your favorite gene or my favorite gene. And if we blow up and look at what my favorite gene consists of, it basically consists of two bits. There's a part that gets transcribed and converted into this informational intermediate mRNA. And that's going to include something called the coding sequence that has the linear series of nucleotides that gets converted, gets translated into a linear series of amino acids necessary to make a protein. So we've got this sort of there's the transcribe bit that I'm going to simplify and call a coding sequence, and then you've got a promoter. A promoter contains all the regulatory elements to tell this when to turn on and where to turn on, or and under what cues to turn on. Okay, that's important to know. Now, if we want to measure gene expression, turns out that my favorite gene might be really hard to measure, might be hard to assay. But there are other genes whose products are really easy to assay, and I'll show you one called luciferase. We'll talk about that in a minute. We'll call that my second favorite gene as opposed to my favorite gene. And it turns out you can take the regulatory elements, the promoter of my favorite gene, and plug that in front of the coding sequence of my second favorite gene. And we're now going to make this guy regulated according to the stuff that normally regulates this guy. And this is easy to assay, so we're going to measure this, and from that we're going to infer what's going on about this guy. And that is the model for regulation of gene expression modularity. It's Mr. Potato Head. You can mix and match these bits and pieces, and it works beautifully. And this works at many, many, many levels in biology. If I were studying the function of a particular gene, it turns out you can be modular there. You can take this functional domain and that functional domain, splice them together, and do all kinds of fun things. So this concept of modularity comes up over and over again. But it's important in terms of gene expression. We're going to use this all the time, basically. And my second favorite gene is the gene that encodes luciferase. Luciferase is the gene that gets transcribed and then translated into a protein, a gene product, that makes light, an enzyme called luciferase. This was discovered in 1885 that fruit flies make an enzyme, luciferase, that oxidizes its substrate, luciferin, that's also made by the firefly. And when it does that, there's a release of photons. There's light generated and it glows. And there's the chemical reaction that's going on. And so what you can do is you can take your favorite gene promoter. In the case of Andrew Miller, who generated these data, his favorite gene was a gene involved in photosynthesis. And he spliced it in front of the firefly enzyme that encodes luciferase, the gene for this. And then he imaged these plants. This is one seedling imaged in the middle of the subjective day. And there's a lot of pseudocolor there, meaning there's a lot of photons coming off. A CCD camera is counting these photons. So you see a lot of light, and if you image that same seedling 12 hours later, there's almost no light. And so this works really well, and you can scale it up as it turns out. You can grow 96 Arabidopsis seedlings, one each in the wells of microtiter plates, one of their natural habitats. And then you can transfer them into an acetylation counter made by Packard called the Top Count. And you can put a whole stack of these plates up in here, and it'll load them. This computer over here will load them into this little box, and it'll systematically count the photons coming out from each of those 96 wells or 96 seedlings. And then it'll spit that out and stack it up in the back and plug in the next one. And so I didn't develop this. Steve Kay developed this, but he was good enough to help me implement it because Steve pointed out that, you know, having your students harvest RNA every 4 hours for a week is no way to recruit individuals into the lab. Torture, I believe, comes to mind. And so now, my lab is not a particularly technical lab, but we did come up with one innovation. I showed you Chig Wong and Xiao Dong. They're husband and wife. And the problem with the Top Count is it's moving parts. And they're not designed to cycle over and over and over again, so they stick a lot. And they invariably, Murphy's Law says, they will stick 10 minutes after you last check them and go home to sleep. And so you have an 8-hour gap in your data set. That really stinks. So one of my graduate students started sleeping in the lab for critical things and wake up and check it. And indeed, Chig Wong adopted that. But Xiao Dong was also doing experiments, and she clearly wears the pants in the family because Chig Wong would have to sleep in the lab when she was doing an experiment as well. Chig Wong is a smart guy, and he said, oh, I've got a webcam. I can point that at the computer screen and log in from home and ask, are we still capturing data? And if we are, I can roll over and go back to bed. So, you know, innovation. So if you do that, you get these lovely rhythmic traces. This is the standard paradigm. We'll grow seedlings under a light-dark cycle, and after a number of those in training cycles, we're going to release them into continuous conditions, in this case continuous light, and the gray is going to be where the lights would have gone off had they gone off, but these guys are in continuous conditions. If you look in a light-dark cycle, you notice Andrew Miller's favorite gene, CAB2, this photosynthetic chain peaks in the early light phase, every day, peaking about every 24 hours. And when you release into continuous conditions, it continues to oscillate. Now, the period gets longer, but it's in free-running conditions, and it's circadian. It's approximately, but not exactly, 24 hours. Here's another gene, one of my favorite genes, catalase. It's a catalase. And it does everything that this gene does. It just does it at a different time of day. So we can get really nice data. Now, doing a lot of forward and reverse genetics, people and plants have come up with a core oscillator. What do you need to make an oscillator? Well, all you really need is some sort of a negative feedback loop, some sort of cycle. And in this case, through forward and reverse genetics, through forward genetics, Steve Kay's lab got a mutant, and they called it TOC1, which is a cute name. And it turns out that TOC1 is actually an activator of a pair of transcription factors called CCA1 and LHY. CCA1 was found through reverse genetics. They found it for other reasons, and then they asked, does it have an effect on the clock when you screw it up? It does. LHY was found through forward genetics. It was found through a mutant screen. This guy is formally a positive regulator of these guys. These guys are defined as negative regulators of that guy. It's been shown biochemically. And so we've got a negative feedback loop. Somebody turns on, and the product of who it turns on turns it off again. And if you throw in a time delay or two, voila, you've got a 24-hour cycle. So that's, in a nutshell, how you can make a clock. If you talk about Mary's hamsters, they basically have exactly the same clock going on, the same logic. The components that have been recruited to do this are quite distinct, but the logic applies of these negative feedback loops. Now, you can ask questions like, where are the genes expressed that are involved in the clock? And again, we're going to take this little seed, and we're going to put that seed about here. There's a picture of the seed, and there's some light being made by that seed. Then the seedling's going to elongate. What we did was Chigwang just put a seed right there, and he imaged it from the minute it hydrated, hitting this medium. And so if we go here and watch, and you want to watch right about there, I think. So it's waiting 24, oh, there's a little bit of a glow. And then, well, look at this, boom. And it's elongating, boom. So it's peaking with the circadian rhythm. There were no time cues at all applied to this. We just took a seed, put it on there in the dark, let it go. This is totally endogenous. It's programmed to run with 24-hour cycles. Now, in some other reverse genetics we've done, we worked at a couple of genes called PRR7 and PRR9. PRRs, they're cousins to TOC1 that I showed you a minute ago. And we wanted to test the hypothesis, are they involved in clock function? And so we did reverse genetics. We found a gene, and we knocked out its function. We're not going to talk about how we did it, but we did it. Actually, other people didn't. We just phoned the seed store, and they sent us the seeds, and we tested them. That's one of the advantages of working in Arabidopsis. And so in one of these rhythmic traces where Columbia, that's the wild type from which this mutant was developed, you'll notice that by the time you get out here, they start out in phase. By the time you get out, the mutant is lagging a little behind. That's because it has a longer period by measuring these two different genes. The same is true for PRR9. But it turns out, what happens if you combine these two mutations in one plant? They're both a little long. If we make the double mutant, which is now in purple, you'll notice it's really long. There's a synergistic interaction. There must be some sort of functional redundancy between these two genes. And if you knock them both out, you really exaggerate the effects. Now, so through this type of work in a lot of labs, chiefly Steve Kay and people from his lab, but a bunch of other people, we've come up with, here's that center core of the model that I showed you with LHY and CCA1 and TOC1. So that's what I showed you a minute ago. But it turns out there are actually multiple interlocked negative feedback loops. So we have this central loop. And then if you notice my friends, PRR7 and 9, they're over here in another loop. That's a negative feedback loop. LHY and CCA1 turn these guys on, and these guys turn LHY and CCA1 off. So we have another interlocked feedback loop. And there's actually five of these PRR proteins. TOC1 is also PRR1, 3, 5, 7, and 9. And they play prominent roles in all of these loops. They're a pretty important clock family. I'm going to just zip through this pretty quickly because I threw in some data slides. Because Sam, are you out there? I didn't think. Yeah, Sam Hazen thought he'd come over here, and he didn't. But anyway, I asked a question. Actually, my student Patrice Salome asked the question. We get this really long period in the double mutant 7 and 9. And why is that? And we wanted to ask, this predicts that the only thing that they do is turn these guys off. So you get this really long period. What would happen if we got rid of those? Do you see the long period because of an interaction through that? So we're going to make, actually, we're going to take away this function and ask if this phenotype goes away. So this is another version of a slide I just showed you where we have Columbia oscillating with about a 24-hour period, and then PR79 has this really long period. And we can get rid of these guys through another technique that we don't need to know about. It's been known that if you take away both functions, if you knock them both out, instead of getting a long period, you actually get a very short period. So there's wild type cycling. And you notice this guy's cycling really fast. So what happens if we combine all these four mutations in one plant? Do we get this long period phenotype? Do we get this short period phenotype? Or do we get some sort of additive interaction? Well, it turns out, I color-coded them. The quad here is in black. This short period guy is here in red. And you notice you can basically superimpose. So basically, you completely lose the phenotype associated with this guy, and it's all this. And you can interpret that as saying that all their function requires these guys to be around for you to see it. So they are, that model that we came up with that had them running through this is probably right. It's consistent. The reason we see the effect, the long period, because these guys are lost is because we're getting too much of these guys. They've lost regulation. If you eliminate them entirely, you lose the long period influence of those. So that was for the aficionados, but we'll get back to the other stuff. Do rhythms matter? Well, I told you I was going to show you these data. These are data from an English collaborator, well, colleague, Alex Webb. And there's several panels here, but we're gonna start on this one. This is the plant version of baseball. And we're going to measure growth, basically, through biomass. So we're going to take a wild type Arabidopsis seedling that has a period of approximately 24 hours, and we're going to grow it in 12-12 cycles, 24-hour cycles. Or we're going to grow it in 14-14, 28-hour cycles, or 10-10, 10 hours light, 10 hours dark, 20-hour cycles. Notice that its maximum biomass is in this cycle that it's used to. If you change the cycles, it doesn't do so well. And photosynthesis falls off in these plants about 50%. So this is a pretty drastic effect. If you take, if you eliminate CCA1 function through overexpressing it, you can see again the wild type is really screwed up. And this is the equivalent of baseball. This is home and away. ZTL has a long period of about 28 hours. You can grow that in 28-hour cycles, it does really well. If you grow it in 20-hour cycles, it doesn't do so well. So it's not, there's nothing sacred about 24 hours. It just happens to be that's the world. What matters is that your clock resonates with the environmental cycle that's being imposed on it. And for the geologists who are out there's data from coral rings and so on and so forth. The Earth, like all of us, is slowing down as it ages. And actually, life didn't evolve under 24-hour cycles. It evolved under much shorter cycles, and it's getting longer and longer. So it's probably going to look complicated because you take this endogenous thing, and then you've got to lengthen the period progressively, and so you keep appending bells and whistles, and it looks like a Rube Goldberg apparatus because it probably is a Rube Goldberg apparatus. Now, I talked about forward and reverse genetics to identify clock components. It stands to reason, if you look around the room, we don't all look the same. There's a lot of variation in humans. Here's that equivalent experiment done in Arabidopsis accessions. These are 24 types of Arabidopsis isolated from around the globe, and they don't look all the same either. Are their clocks all the same? Well, for this, we're going to go back to that leaf movement rhythm. Here's Arabidopsis now grown in 24 well microtiter plates, stood in front of a CCD camera, a Panasonic actually video camera of the sort you see every time you go to an ATM. And we're going to take their picture every 20 minutes for a while. And so what we did, the experimental protocol is what we always do. We entrained these seedlings for several days in light-dark cycles, and then we release them into continuous lights, and so they're not getting any more time cues, and we're going to ask, do they cycle? And so I want you to focus on that seedling and that seedling. So there we go. They're doing their little calisthenic thing, and they're cycling. You'll notice, though, if you compare this guy to this guy is in a terrible hurry relative to that guy. They're doing the same thing, but this guy is slower. And so what we can do is we dump those images into a time series, and then we can use a computer to spit out the y-coordinates of the pixel of the leaves, and we get, again, we get oscillations. This is just like that lamp black thing I showed you earlier, but a lot easier. And the guy on the right, who was sort of dawdling, that's actually a wild type with a period of about 25 hours. The guy on the left who was in such a hurry is actually the TOC1 mutant, which you take away that gene, the period shortens by about 3 hours to about 22 hours. And so it's a great assay, and it has a big advantage over luciferase because it's not transgenic. So I don't have to introduce any genes into the plants. I can just measure any plant you give me, including plants from all over the globe. And you just go out and do it. So we can ask the question, in this case, we is Todd Michael, who was a graduate student in my lab, and he's just left a tenure-track job at Rutgers to move to Monsanto, of all things. But he asked the question, is there natural variation in the Arabidopsis clock? And so he measured a collection of 150 accessions from all over the place, and he found, yeah, lots of variation. If you just consider period length, the number of accessions, you can see period range from less than 22 hours to almost 29 hours. The modal value was about 24, but there were long period variants and short period variants, and they bred true. If you took seeds from this guy, it self-fertilizes, and you'll get 29-hour plants out of this. Take seeds from this guy, you get 22-hour plants out of it. So there's a huge amount of range. The same's true of period, the same's true of amplitude. There was an interesting and tantalizing correlation of period length with latitude. And you can see where we're going. Is the clock important across latitudinal gradients where you're exposed to different photoperiods at different times of year? It wasn't significant, but you notice this, it almost looked curvilinear. And we asked ourselves, what's curvilinear with latitude? Well, of course, day length. And so if we simply transformed the latitudes into day length at the summer solstice, we actually got a significant correlation out of the deal. So maybe the clocks are important. Period, it lengthens as you go farther north across a latitudinal climb, and maybe that helps you measure time, anticipate dawn appropriately at higher latitudes. So now we're going to have to do the genetics bit, but we're going to start out doing genetics bit with simple probability. We're going to flip a coin. And you all know the answer to this. If you flip a coin, unless somebody's cheating on you, the probability of heads is a half, and the probability of tails is a half. I think we can all accept that, right? What's the probability of two heads in a row? Well, in theory, they're independent events. So the probability of heads the first time is a half. The probability of heads is the second time is a half. The probability of two heads in a row is the product of those independent probabilities, or a quarter. If you can do this level of math, you too can be a geneticist. Probability of two tails in a row? Well, I think you know the answer to that now. It's the same. It's a half times a half. What's the probability of one head followed by one tail? Well, it's a half times a half is a quarter. This is getting boring, right? Probability of one tail followed by one head. You know the answer. What's the probability then of getting one head and one tail in two sequential flips? Well, it's going to be some of those independent probabilities. The probability of one head followed by one tail plus the probability of one tail followed by one head. There's two ways to get there. This is all genetics is this sort of additive stuff. And so, you know, it's a half times a half plus a half times a half is a quarter plus a quarter. It's a half. So if you can do that level of math, you can be a geneticist. And we'll show that now, because, of course, it's the 200th birthday of Gregor Mendel. And it's 150th anniversary of On the Origin of Species. So this is Darwin. I'm not going to show you a picture of Mendel. But Gregor Mendel figured out this gene inheritance stuff. I guess he spent a lot of time flipping coins. And Okay, the nomenclature in genetics, big A, little a, for those of you who've taken genetics, you notice, you know this is the universal language. We, like Mendel's peas, are diploids. We have two copies of each of our genes. You got one from mom, you got the other one from dad. In this case, you got big A from mom, you got big A from dad. Somebody else might have gotten little a from mom and little a from dad. But well, we can ask, what happens when you and your partner start making babies? Well, the only thing the left parent can give you is big A's. The only thing the right parent can give you is little a's. So the progeny are going to be big A, little a for that particular gene. And we use a fancy word for that. We call it heterozygous. What happens if you let these guys self-fertilize like we would with Arabidopsis? If you're going to do this with hamsters or mice, you have to do sib matings. But you can do this cross. You can cross big A, little a times big A, little a. And this is where the coin toss comes in. The probability of this guy giving a big A is a half. The probability of this guy giving a little a is a half. So you can see why we did the coin toss stuff. So everything's a half, and we know that a half times a half is a quarter. So let's systematically work through it. What's the probability of big A coming out of that cross? Well, a half of the time you get a big A from this guy, and a half the time you get big A from that guy. So the probability is a half times a half is a quarter. My bet is the math is going to be the same for this guy. Half times a half is a quarter. And here's that labored coin toss example. The probability of getting big A, you know, and little a, big A from dad, little a from mom, probability of getting the vice versa, and you just add them up. And it turns out the probabilities, if you sum them, they ought to be 1. It's a quarter plus a half plus a quarter. That's the famous 1 to 2 to 1 ratio that Mendel figured out. That's all you need to know to be a geneticist. And that's all you need to know to be a quantitative geneticist. And now I'm going to show you why we went through that. To do quantitative genetics, we've taken advantage of something called recombinant inbred lines. And it's big A, little a, trust me. So what you do is you take one accession of Arabidopsis. Now, in the wild, Arabidopsis mostly inbreeds. So that means if you find a plant, it's almost always going to be entirely homozygous. It's going to have two copies of the same gene all the way through, all along the chromosomes. So we're going to draw its two chromosomes as both red. We're going to cross it to its cousin, Landsberg erecta, which comes from Landsberg, Poland, as the name might sound. And it's going to be also homozygous, but different. It's going to be blue, and this guy's going to be red. Don't draw any political, this is a value-neutral judgment. So if we cross those guys, what are we going to get in their progeny? Well, they're going to get a red chromosome from Colombia and a blue chromosome from Landsberg. Okay, that's pretty obvious. What happens if we let these guys self-fertilize? At every gene along this chromosome and along the other four chromosomes, think of them as big A, little a. And you're just going to do this over and over again, and all these events will be independent. And so it breaks down a little bit because if two guys are really close together, it's not really independent. But the top here, big A, little a, is going to be independent of big A, little a to the end down here. And so if you cross them, at every generation of crossing, you're going to lose half the heterozygosity because big A was a quarter, little a was a quarter. So a half the progeny are now homozygous and can't segregate any stuff anymore. If you do this about 8 times, these guys are going to be, you're going to get all these sort of recombinations, you're going to get mixing and matching, you're going to get a bunch of plants that are absolutely homozygous at any particular place. I need to go down one more for that. You go through this, you're going to wind up with guys that are the same at every chromosomal position, but they're going to be on average half from one grandparent and half from the other grandparent. So you've basically taken those two genomes and you've mixed them up. And you've made what we call recombinant inbred lines. They're recombinant because we've mixed and matched stuff from Landsberg and stuff from Columbia. They're inbred. We've inbred them a bunch of times. They're now homozygous. And they're lines because that's a good word for descent by single seeds. And so you take about, in our case, 79 of these guys generated by Claire Lister and Carolyn Dean, and you can now measure these guys for circadian rhythms. When we do that, you see every bit as much variation among them as we saw in that global collection in terms of period, phase, and amplitude. Okay, that's cool. There's a lot of stuff segregating in these, and it's behaving additively. It's like there are a whole bunch of period shorteners and a whole bunch of period lengtheners. The reason both these parents have about a 24-hour period is they average out. They've got about as many lengtheners as shorteners. But if you just scramble their genomes and let stuff randomly assort, some guys get all the shorteners and they're out here, and some guys get all the lengtheners and they're out here. Okay, that's cool. That tells us something about how this is going. We can use it even more because we can attempt to correlate inheritance of either Columbia or Landsberg DNA at any particular place along those chromosomes with inheritance of period length and ask, can we map any genes that are contributing to period length? And when we do that, it's a big slide, we do that. Here's four of the five chromosomes of Arabidopsis arrayed along the x-axis. This is something called Laud score. It's a measure of significance. And tau is clock speak for period length. In the middle of chromosome 1, there are two loci that seem to segregate positively correlated with period length. So there's probably two genes on this chromosome that are contributing to period length. There's another period one over here. We've got a phase one, phi for phase, down here on the bottom of chromosome 5. We've got an amplitude one here in the middle of chromosome 2. So we can do this in Arabidopsis, and now we can attempt to identify what genes are responsible for this. And that's a lot of work and a complicated story. Oops. So now what I want to do is use that to introduce the last little mini story here. Arabidopsis, I love Arabidopsis. It's near and dear to my heart. If you're going to work in plants, it's the way to work because of those community strengths. But, you know, we don't eat a lot of Arabidopsis. Ultimately, you know, as I say to my pre-medical students, you can cure cancer, but we still got to eat. And as we know, we're having a little bit of problem with population. We're also having a little problem with land degradation, climate change. We're going to have to make a lot more food on a lot less land. And so we're going to have to try and ask, is Arabidopsis a good model in a crop? We're going to take a baby step to move to a crop called Brassica rapa, Chinese cabbage. And we're going to ask, does the clock matter at all for agriculture? And so here's some pictures that show an Arabidopsis flower versus a Brassica flower, an Arabidopsis seed versus a Brassica seed, an Arabidopsis plant versus a Brassica plant. And there's a clump of Arabidopsis and a Brassica plant. So is it a good model? Just a little bit more about, there's a lot of Brassica rapa is really cool because there are a lot of cultivated leafy types. It also makes turnips. And it's also an oil seed. Some strains of canola are Brassica rapa. And it's one of the genomes that's a contributor. It's one of the parents for canola. And the reason we're doing this is because it's another anniversary. It's the anniversary of the death of this guy here, Norman Borlaug, who's won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970 because he was the father of the Green Revolution. And the Nobel Committee said, more than any other single person of this age, he has helped to provide bread for a hungry world. He was a plant breeder, and he bred these dwarf wheats and dwarf rices that allowed Mexico and India to become self-sufficient for grain. And it's been said he saved more lives than any man living, except unfortunately the poor man's not living anymore. He just died this fall. But he's a great, great man. And finally, after 20 years of trying, we managed to persuade the honorary degree committee at Dartmouth to, this is mostly the work of my wife, Mary Lou Garino, to give him an honorary degree. And he came up, and it was just it was a wonderful day. So you don't get to meet your heroes all that often. So, okay, that's what we're doing, transitioning to a crop plant. And why? Well, the theoretical efficiency of conversion of solar energy into chemical energy, that's photosynthesis, it's about 3 to 6%. But right now, current crops typically achieve only 0.1 to 0.2%. There's clearly a huge amount of room to improve this. And we've got to improve this because we need to eat more. We need more food. Brassica rapa, like Arabidopsis, grows across a broad latitudinal range. And it's subjected to distinct photoperiodic and temperature conditions. I showed you that in that latitudinal cline of photoperiods. I showed you data that says that the resonance of the clock with the environmental period enhances fitness and plant productivity. So really the question then is, can we manipulate the clock, for example, period length, to design crops that are better suited to latitudinal ranges? A crop grown in Florida is exposed to very different environments from one grown in Minnesota. Can we make designer crops that will perform better in those photoperiodic and temperature regimes? So that's where we're going to try and go. And that's why we're trying to move into a crop. Also, there are more crass arguments for why to work in crops. The NSF dangles the funding carrot in crops, and you ignore that at your peril. So if you want to stay funded, you want to work on a crop. And so we did exactly the same experiment, quantitative traits with recombinant inbred lines. Fetty Lai crossed a yellow-seeded yellow sarsen R500 with a brown-seeded rapid cycling IMB211, the romantic names. Here's R500, here's IMB. IMB, it's already flowering compared to this guy at 3 weeks of age. And he made recombinant inbred lines. And of course, you know the shtick. We can now look at these guys. These are Brassica rapa seedlings. In the same sort of thing, and trained to light-dark cycles, transferred into continuous light. And then the nice thing is the NSF gave us a lot of cameras so we can look at a lot of these little guys in our growth chamber and do this as a high throughput. And basically, you know, if I hadn't colored it blue as opposed to red, this is the Arabidopsis data over again. It's exactly the same. Huge range in period lengths, in phases, and in amplitude. We've done it now at two temperatures. We've actually done it at three temperatures. And so we've mapped QTLs. And there's a QTL, for example, for period length here on the middle of chromosome 9. It coincides with a length of the first internode that may or may not be related. And we're collaborating with Cynthia Weinig at University of Wyoming, who's measured all these morphometric things like hypocotyl length and petiole length. And we're asking, is the clock actually interacting with morphological parameters as well? We're now trying very hard to clone this particular QTL. We have a candidate, and I'm pretty confident we've cloned it, but which, you know, if we have, I'll get my grant renewed. Okay, so I'd like to summarize. Molecular biology, the theme there is modularity. That's Mr. Potato Head. Genetics is as easy as a half times a half equals a quarter. Remember that. If you're interviewing for graduate school, I will ask you, what happens when you cross big A, little a by big A, little a? It turns out almost all of the students coming to graduate school or interviewing for graduate school can answer that. It's a good thing. And that means they know enough to work in my lab. This is the salient. Plants are cool, right? I mean, did you think you'd see all this stuff? And then, so the serious thing, feeding the world is going to require considerable effort. We need to know a lot more about basic plant biology. Molecular biology, and in particular transgenic plants, can help to assist conventional breeding. And even if you don't believe in GMOs and you don't want to eat them, if we can figure this out transgenically in the lab, we can use that to provide the sort of markers and know-how to help the breeders manipulate in a much more knowledgeable way, do, if you will, intelligent design of their plants.